And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And again, thank you to Living the Dream Coaches, Coach's Corner, every second Monday from 2 to 3, Joe and Laurie Battaglia. And now, one of the truly great shows here on 1010 AM, Breakthrough Thinking, Understanding Autism, Kimberly Isaac, Paul Alden. How are you guys?
Good.
Doing all right.
Good. How was Houston?
Warm.
Warm, and it's been cold out here. It even snowed in Scottsdale, I heard.
Really?
Is that weird? I tried to ski, and it melted before I got there. Very strange. Anyway, back to you, Kim. You got a great guest today, don't you?
We do. We have a great guest. We have Dr. Christopher Nichols from the Nichols Group. He's a clinical psychologist, and he's with us to talk about the upcoming changes in the DSM. So we're going to talk about that. Dr. Nichols, are you on the line?
I am. I'm here.
Oh, good. Welcome. Thank you so much for guesting.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I was thinking maybe we could start with, maybe you could just briefly explain what the DSM actually is.
Sure. DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. It's the book that has been written by the American Psychiatric Association in which the criteria for various mental illnesses or psychiatric illnesses are listed. So this becomes sort of the coding manual that is used by physicians, by insurance companies, by government organizations, so that people are on the same page when they describe a certain condition. What is autism? What is an anxiety disorder? What is an attention deficit disorder? So it lists a variety of rules, if you will, or criteria that one has to meet in order to get a certain diagnosis.
Okay. So the big kind of buzz, I know, in the autism world here is the upcoming change to the diagnostic criteria for autism spectrum disorders. And so I guess I was kind of wondering if you knew why is there going to be a change? Why have they decided to make the changes?
Well, there were several reasons that the American Psychiatric Association wanted to make the change, largely stemming from research over the last 20 years or so as to how effective the diagnoses are and how well they work. So previously, in the fourth edition of the DSM, there was a collection of conditions that were called pervasive developmental disorders. So that included autistic disorder, Asperger's disorder, something called Rett's disorder, something called childhood disintegrative disorder, and another thing called pervasive developmental disorder. All of these different diagnoses were used to try to describe children who had primarily social impairments and some qualitative differences in their patterns of behaviors and interests. And it was originally thought that these were very real and distinct categories of behaviors that we could use to differentiate among people with the hope that maybe that would lead to different kinds of treatment outcomes or service provision. But I think what has been decided is that most of the research says there isn't a whole lot of difference between the various conditions based on the criteria that were written. And in fact, what it was doing was to often pull in very specific behaviors or very specific characteristics that may or may not be present in a given individual, and the feeling was that we were splitting hairs. So the new manual is combining these various conditions under a term, autism spectrum disorder, which is actually a term that was first used by a woman named Lorna Wing in England back in the 80s, and Dr. Wing was the first person to translate Leo Kanner and Hans Asperger's writings in German into English. So she had various subcategories within that autism spectrum disorder. But the idea is that there's a continuum of conditions, that maybe range in severity and maybe differ according to level of an individual's intelligence, but all sort of measure the same continuum.
Okay. And just to clarify for people, too, the DSM is applicable to both children and adults. Is that right?
That's right. It's okay. They have a category for disorders first diagnosed in infancy, childhood, or adolescence. But, yeah, it's a lifespan categorizing system.
Okay. So now kind of the question everybody's probably on the edge of their seat about, which is, what are the changes that are being made?
Well, it's hard to know exactly because we don't yet have the final version of the criteria that DSM-5 is going to use. But when we looked at the kinds of preliminary reports that were released when the APA was asking for public input on the condition, they basically have said that you have to have four criterion for the autism spectrum disorders. You have to have some kind of a persistent deficit in social communication and social interaction as the first one. You then have to have some kind of restrictive or repetitive patterns of behavior, interests, and activities. Your symptoms have to have been present in early childhood, although they don't necessarily have to have been fully manifest until social demands exceed your capacity. So there are individuals who are not diagnosed until adulthood.
Right.
And then finally, symptoms have to limit or impair everyday functioning in some way. So in many ways, what they're doing is to define broader categories, primarily the emphasis on social interaction and atypical interest behaviors or activities, but they're having fewer specific criteria and saying that you have to meet all of them.
I was going to say, this sounds a lot like what used to be the symptoms just for Asperger's, the sort of broader symptoms that were there.
That's true. That's true. And in fact, in the DSM-4, really the only difference between the autistic disorder criteria and the Asperger disorder criteria is that in autism, you had to have qualitative impairments in communication. And I think the realization has come about that that may have been more associated with other cognitive abilities that vary across individuals, and that the real issues are the social interaction and patterns of behavior. So they decided to remove that communication component.
Yeah, so this is really helpful. I think having the four criteria, kind of the bullet points here that you're giving us, I mean, I know the actual final copy doesn't come out until May. Something that I think I've been getting, you know, comments on or feedback on is some people feel, you know, anxious or even upset that there is going to be a change at all, most particularly adults who have Asperger's. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, how will these changes affect, I'm curious about that particular group and then in general.
Sure. I think there's probably good and bad in here. The good is the recognition that some of these criteria or conditions really do impact and to a certain degree impair the functioning of otherwise pretty high-functioning individuals. So on a positive note, I think there are many people who maybe have not received services or have been excluded from services because they have a college degree or because they have a master's degree and they're otherwise very intelligent individuals, with the presumption being, well, you're educated, how bad can it be? And so positively, I think it may open the door for some services for people. The concerns that I have heard is that people who have already been provided accommodations or services or have been found eligible under, say, Social Security or special education criteria may lose their services, And at this point, I don't think there's any evidence that that's going to happen. To the best of my knowledge, people are not going to have any services that they currently have taken away from them.
Okay, that's good to know. Yeah, because that was part of, you know, one of the other questions is how will it affect services? And I know that, you know, it is kind of hard to tell at this point.
And I know my understanding of the Americans with Disability Act and the way it's supposed to interact with things is that it's supposed to be very much focused on the actual nature of the disability more than the labels, what you are and aren't able to do and what is a reasonable accommodation for the specific challenges you have, rather than does this person have a specific diagnosis?
That's absolutely correct. So if we say, okay, well, persistent deficits in social communication and social interaction, well, the sub-criteria are deficits in what is called social-emotional reciprocity. So that might include how comfortable a person is in approaching someone at work and initiating interaction and having sort of back-and-forth conversations over the water cooler. And I've had clients who have told me that they have, in essence, been fired or laid off because they weren't able to join the culture of their employment agency. They were on the outskirts and had the feeling that they were kind of pushed out because they weren't a part of the social culture of the office, even though they were very qualified and skilled in the actual job performance. So having this written down as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA, I think, is going to be helpful.
Why don't we take a quick break right now? When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with special guest Dr. Chris Nichols of the Nichols Group. And this is Understanding Autism. We're talking about DSM, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. DSM, not quite out yet, but ready to be finalized. We'll be right back.
Hopefully, you'll never have to experience a disaster such as a fire or a flood striking your home or business. But if you do, know there's someone out there who can quickly help you get life back to normal. That someone is ServiceMaster by Disaster Professionals. Just call 602-431-2222, and our professionals will be there to lend a hand. You can be confident knowing ServiceMaster Clean has over 50 years of experience restoring damaged homes and businesses after frightening events such as fires, floods, vandalisms, and other disasters. We can offer services such as emergency cleaning, smoke, soot, and odor removal, in addition to water and fire damage repair. Our solid reputation is the reason insurance companies nationwide know ServiceMaster Clean will get the job done quickly and professionally. Plus, we guarantee to do the work right the first time, or we'll do it over with no questions asked. That's ServiceMaster Clean. We're the company that's first to respond to your call, first to arrive on the scene, and first to guarantee relief. Because delays and hassles are the last thing you need. Remember, 602-431-2222 for ServiceMaster Clean by Disaster Professionals. And get the clean you expect and the service you deserve.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIAdvisors.com. That's RIIAdvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIAdvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. We have a special guest, Dr. Chris Nichols from the Nichols Group, and we're talking about DSM-5. Wow, these initials sound like scientific and stuff. Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We're talking in relation to autism, and Paul, you have a question.
Well, hopefully they are as scientific as we can get, but I think we wanted to start with asking about the process that went into moving from the DSM-4 to the DSM-5. Who's making the decisions? How are they deciding what changes get made? Basically, what has gone through and what is going through the last steps before we get the new manual?
Well, to some degree, it's unclear. The American Psychiatric Association periodically reviews its diagnostic manual, and so what they would do is to go out and find individuals who are considered to be experts in various conditions. Those individuals then are formed into what are called work groups, and they then meet and review new research and try to decide, is the current way of looking at various conditions rational? Is there evidence to support a change? What's new in the field, et cetera? So in the DSM-5, there were some 13 different work groups looking at different conditions. So there was an anxiety disorder group, there was a substance abuse group, et cetera. And these groups would meet, review research, develop proposals, and then those proposals are reviewed by other people, including the public. So there has been a period of time where public commentary was invited on the proposed changes in the DSM-5. Professional comments were solicited. Some field trials of new criteria have been studied in select populations with select practitioners. And then they take all of that information and go behind closed doors to come up with their final manual, which theoretically will be released later this spring.
I know in relation to the public comment part, there have been some people who've been very afraid that it will significantly decrease the rate of diagnosis for autism. I've seen numbers from 15% less people diagnosed to something like 45%. And I was just wondering if you had any insight in – I could never find specific details as to why they thought less people would be diagnosed, or whether they thought that they were just going to be losing it altogether or maybe fall under some new condition that, you know, they may not have looked at. So I was just wondering if you could offer a little insight into that area.
Well, I can give you my opinions. And those are that I think the previous criteria were vague. So how one interpreted whether an individual met a certain criterion was very sort of nonspecific and therefore led to both over-identification as well as under-identification, depending upon who the person is that's performing the evaluation. So one of their goals, I think, was to make much more specific the nature of the concerns so that there would be greater agreement among people who perform evaluations and actually give the diagnoses. And that, in turn, brings up the fact that I think there has been misinformation and misdiagnosis of what we would call comorbid conditions, meaning other things going on that people began to think were necessary to have a diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder, when in fact they really were not. So, for example, it used to be the case that if you were given a diagnosis of an autism spectrum disorder, you were not supposed to then also be given a diagnosis of an attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Well, you know, clinically, I can tell you that I see an awful lot of folks who have both diagnoses, and yet the former book said you shouldn't do that. So, you know, I think positively the DSM-5 is trying to be more clear, more research-based, to reflect new advancements in the field. But what that's going to result in is that people are going to have to be much more specific in their definition of terms. And so it remains to be seen if the incidence actually changes and by how much versus how often what we're really doing is just separating out different things that tend to co-occur that you you might see one individual who has two or three sets of different symptoms, whereas another person may just have one set.
So if everything's working right, if someone loses their autism diagnosis, it's because they've probably fallen into a category that better fits them and better helps someone pick out appropriate treatment options. Is that what I'm understanding?
That would be a useful goal, yes.
Yeah, that would definitely be the goal. I mean, that's what I'm hoping.
Well, that's what I said. If everything's working right.
Definitely. So will people, I mean, the question on some people's minds, too, is people who are currently diagnosed with Asperger's or actually just with autism, will they need to get re-diagnosed once the changes occur? Or is there a benefit to that? Or how is that going to work?
Yeah, I don't know. I have not heard anything that says that school districts or, say, the Disability Determination Service will require reevaluations, but we'll have to see how that works in the in the time to come. Certainly, there are questions of can you grow out of autism? Some people who, as they get older, seem to develop skills in areas that were previously problematic for them, seem to have a reduction in the number and or severity of their symptoms. And so that raises the question of, well, did they have autism in the first place? Or is this really a developmental disorder that can get better over time? And so that speaks to the issue of severity. And I think one of the other things that the DSM is trying to do is to add in a dimensional analysis according to severity. So you may have a mild level of impairment or a moderate level of impairment or a substantial level of impairment. And this is similar to what's being done in the field of intellectual disabilities, where we no longer just talk about what's your IQ, but we speak in terms of what level of support does a person need and what are their adaptive behavioral skills like. And I think this is important because there are many individuals who have what previously we would call high-functioning autism, meaning that they really perform quite well in a variety of ways and environments and certain kinds of skills, and they really just needs support in a few areas. So that may speak more to the issue of severity rather than do you or do you not have autism.
I know that in my personal life, I've diagnosed with Asperger's, that there have definitely been some times where I've tried to explain the challenges I have to people who are definitely doubtful as to whether I really have a disorder or whether what I have are real. And I know that having a diagnosis that explicitly says that this person is at a level where they need some moderate or some mild degree of help from time to time is probably more helpful to me than having a diagnosis that says they've got this disorder that makes them a bit socially awkward. You know, that having the need for help explicitly as part of the diagnosis would be sort of a meaningful positive change in my life in some ways.
Well, that's right, because I think of many people who are not aware of the whole spectrum think of autism in terms of the most severely impaired, and therefore when they come across someone who is bright and articulate and educated, they say, well, there's no way this person could be autistic.
And a lot of times people who are mildly autistic have a hard time explaining the kind of challenges that they have, so that sort of creates a double challenge to them because they have to make someone realize it's real but have difficulty talking about what they really have challenges with at the same time.
Absolutely. I actually this morning was talking with a gentleman who has been having difficulty maintaining his employment. He's actually a pretty functional aerospace engineer, but his employer required that he rotate positions within the company according to a set schedule, and that's often very difficult for people on the spectrum who like to have a set routine and at times are have difficulty managing change. Well, if he hadn't been forced every so many weeks to move to a new workstation, he could have performed at a very high level, and his employer would have been very pleased, but it was just the interaction of that characteristic with the job requirement that made the problem.
Yeah, well, hopefully employers out there can develop some flexibility, and that might help. Let's take a quick break right now. This is Understanding Autism, special guest Dr. Chris Nichols, the Nichols Group. We're talking about DSM number 5, which is Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, specifically related to autism, and we'll be right back.
Weidenauer, Heighton & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heighton & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today. 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spien works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
Hopefully, you'll never have to experience a disaster such as a fire or a flood striking your home or business. But if you do, know there's someone out there who can quickly help you get life back to normal. That someone is ServiceMaster by Disaster Professionals. Just call 602-431-2222, and our professionals will be there to lend a hand. You can be confident knowing ServiceMaster Clean has over 50 years of experience restoring damaged homes and businesses after frightening events such as fires, floods, vandalisms, and other disasters. We can offer services such as emergency cleaning, smoke, soot, and odor removal, in addition to water and fire damage repair. Our solid reputation is the reason insurance companies nationwide know ServiceMaster Clean will get the job done quickly and professionally. Plus, we guarantee to do the work right the first time, or we'll do it over with no questions asked. That's ServiceMaster Clean. We're the company that's first to respond to your call, first to arrive on the scene, and first to guarantee relief. Because delays and hassles are the last thing you need. Remember, 602-431-2222 for ServiceMaster Clean by Disaster Professionals. And get the clean you expect and the service you deserve.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And this is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Special in-studio guest, we have Dr. Chris Nichols, the Nichols Group, talking about DSM number 5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And, Doctor, I have a question, and I know Paul and Kim have other questions. One is how does this change or enhance or reduce for insurance purposes? Or does it at all?
Well, that again remains to be seen. The one of the purposes of the revision is to increase the accuracy of diagnosis. When you speak about diagnostic accuracy, we use two terms. One is sensitivity, meaning are we able to identify a sufficient number of individuals that it's a useful criteria? The other is specificity, which means are we excluding things that really are not a part of this condition, but perhaps explained by other things? I think insurance companies are increasingly moving toward the idea that they want to see evidence-based diagnosis and treatment of all kinds of conditions. So to the extent that the new changes will result in greater accuracy and that treatments can then be evaluated in terms of a more accurate diagnosis, insurance companies are going to embrace this kind of development. I think the other consideration as well, therefore, is what about the whole Affordable Care Act and the prohibition against insurance companies discriminating against somebody with a prior diagnosis? And here we really just don't know at this point. My contact with people in the insurance company business says that what they are really looking to do is to help their clientele to provide the best care in the most efficient manner, but that there's also a great deal of waste in the healthcare system and misdiagnosis and ineffective treatments, which is what they're really trying to target for reduction in costs. Obviously, healthcare costs are huge, and so any moves to make it a better bang for the buck will be good from the insurance company's standpoint. But bottom line is we really don't know because we don't quite yet know what the criteria will be. We don't quite yet know what the Affordable Care Act will look like, or even within the at the state level, how individual states are going to decide about who is eligible for what level of health care services. So it's really kind of a wait and see.
So do you think for our listeners out there that may, you know, have coverage right now, when there's a change like this to DSM number 5, is there any delay with insurance companies getting their reimbursements out? Is there anything like that that you've seen in the past?
You know, I really don't think I can speak to that. I know that different insurance companies seem to have different rules for which diagnoses they would or would not accept, or which procedure codes they would or would not utilize. There's also a move on the in the medical field, which doesn't necessarily use the DSM. They use something called the International Classification of Diseases, or the ICD Diagnostic Manual, which is really from the World Health Organization. It's the version that's being used right now is the 9th edition, and this year, I believe, will be a transition to the 10th revision of the International Classification of Diseases. So it's not going to affect just mental health, but also all of medicine. And my guess is that different companies will respond with different speed and efficiency, but I don't have anything to base that on.
I actually have a question. I had a couple people ask me about how this, or if it will, affect further research on autism in general. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's one of the hopes, that by having cleaner, more specific and sensitive diagnostic criteria, research is actually going to be enhanced. Over the years, there have been lots of different kinds of tools that have been developed for diagnosticians to use to try to make the diagnosis, some of which are very general, some of which are highly specific. And the APA's work group on autism included some of the sort of major figures in the field who designed some of these diagnostic procedures. So many of the listeners will probably be familiar with something called the ADOS, which is the Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule. That's been considered sort of the gold standard for diagnosis in research circles over the years. The developer of the ADOS is Dr. Catherine Lord, was a part of the DSM work group. So I think there really is a move or a goal of improving the ability to make accurate diagnoses, and that would then in turn lead to better research, because if you have poorly defined criteria for whether you have condition X or Y, then it makes it harder to study that condition in a scientific way, because you get a lot of noise, if you will, in the data. You have lots of people who may really not have that condition. So I think it will lead to greater accuracy in diagnosis, and therefore hopefully improve research along a number of concerns. You know, and obviously there are many dimensions in which research is progressing in autism. But if we're all talking about the same thing, it'll make it a lot easier.
I'm kind of wondering too. I don't know if this is something that's been brought up or anything like that, but I was thinking about the ADOS, and I wonder, is this going to impact the ADOS? Like, could that be revised and updated based on these changes, or is that talked about or thought about?
Yeah, the ADOS is sort of continually being reviewed. There have been changes in it already, and there have been changes in the normative standards by which it gets interpreted. And that's true, really, of all of the various diagnostic scales, that as time goes on, scales get revised, they get renormed, research comes in that says this part of the scale is useful, this part isn't. So that's kind of the nature of how science works, that we revise our tools as we learn more about conditions. So I'm sure that will continue to be the case with these new criteria.
I'm also wondering too, I think I have the dates here somewhere, but the DSM isn't updated too frequently. I think there's like a 10, 12 year span before updating.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is that, I'm guessing, because there needs to be quite a bit of time that goes by, you know, for research and evaluating all the current research. Do you think that will ever change? I mean, research is, increasing. And will that schedule always be that way? Or is there a chance that things would be updated sooner if needed?
Well, unfortunately, I think it's a slow-moving process. So not necessarily in the field of autism, but in other diagnostic categories, say, for example, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, many of the scientists and researchers with whom I have the pleasure of interacting already think the DSM-5 is obsolete.
I've actually heard that, too. I was curious if you were going to say it. I've heard that, too.
And I think it's important that we recognize that the DSM-5 is not necessarily truth. It is consensus, which means it's criteria that we can generally agree upon, and there will always be new developments, dissenting opinions, evidence to the contrary. It's wrong to think of the DSM as reflecting the current state of scientific knowledge regarding anything. What it does do is to give us a consensually based book of rules, if you will, that we can use for a period of time until we change the rules and revise the document. So the fact that it's DSM-5 reflects the fact that this is the fifth revision of this approach to categorizing behavior. And over the course of that progress, certain things have been added, certain things have been eliminated. Many conditions that used to be considered a mental illness, we now realize are not a mental illness, and so they have been removed from the book. So it's certainly not, I don't think, supposed to reflect reality as much as consensus. And to that end, it's useful, but science is a process of always challenging and questioning the status quo to try and get a better understanding.
Right. That's a good point, and I'm glad you kind of explained that about the DSM, because it is a revision, and I think sometimes people do kind of take it so very concrete without thinking about the scientific part of things and how things are always going to be evolving. And so I think that's a really important piece. I'm wondering, too, on your end, I mean, I've had some questions from my clients, and I'm wondering, from your patients, have you had some kind of, obvious reaction or constant questions you're getting from your current patients about the changes?
Not really. I think those who are aware of and have looked into the changes and the criteria sort of nod and say, yeah, well, that makes sense. The concerns I have heard have been from parents who are afraid that they will lose services because perhaps their high-functioning child will no longer trip the trigger for receiving services. But that's really always been the case. So again, going back to the idea of, do you grow out of autism, I've seen students who the schools might provide special education services under the category of autism, and yet the intervention programs that the school provides, that the parents provide, that private therapists have provided, is so good that the level of impairment really drops below the critical point of needing services. So perhaps the person will no longer qualify for an IEP or special education, which doesn't mean that it necessarily goes away, but rather that the level of impairment, going back to that severity thing, isn't sufficient that you need extra help. I mean, really, the goal is for everyone to be as competent and independent and self-sufficient as possible, regardless of what label we apply. So that would occur, you know, that would apply to visual impairment. You know, if you're visually impaired, but yet we can get you good contacts and now you can see well enough to be able to drive and be independent, that's a good thing. That doesn't mean that your visual impairment went away.
And I sort of think that that goes into the question of, like, what the philosophy of the DSM is. I know that with the new edition of the DSM, there have been some disorders that have been placed in it that people have had serious questions about. There's one about depression where people are arguing as to whether it's so broad as to cover natural grief. There's one about eating disorders. I think it's binge eating disorder. And I think one thing might be worth talking about is what the philosophy of the DSM is. Is it, if someone needs help, we use the DSM to identify what kind of help they need? Or is it a case of the DSM tells us whether or not someone needs help? It's sort of, which direction is it coming at it from?
Right. And that's hard to say in a global way, but I think the process of the DSM is a valid one, because what they really do is to review all the scientific literature about a given condition. They look at what is the evidence supporting a change in criteria, and what is the strength of that evidence, how big a change are they really making, and some are very minor, some are modest, or some are major changes. And then we have to see how valid are those changes. How valid is the new criteria, and that really becomes a question of outcome research. So, yes, should grief-related depression be considered a distinct diagnosis, or should it be a form of major depressive disorder, or should it be a diagnosis at all? We tend to want to take symptoms and turn them into disorders. So when is sadness depression? And I think everybody has an opinion about that, but the scientific standard is that you have to meet various criteria to get the diagnosis of depression. And there are different types of depression and characteristics of depression based upon what are your symptoms. So I think it's useful in that regard, because what it does do is it takes it out of subjectivity, makes it more objective, and certainly there are going to be people who disagree with any of the conditions, and the debate is a part of the scientific process. But what happens is you reach consensus of experts in the specific conditions. The changes are, for the most part, modest, are based upon research, and have the goal of increasing accuracy and specificity of what the diagnosis is.
Well, I guess what I was sort of, to clarify a little bit about what I was asking, is, like, are the list of conditions sort of seen as a set of minimum requirements? You can't receive a diagnosis until you meet those conditions? Or are they sort of more of almost a mandate? If you meet those conditions, you have this disorder?
Well, it's two sides to the coin. So one side is, in order to be given a diagnosis, you must meet the criteria specified. So in the new autism spectrum, at least when the proposed criteria were out there, you had to meet all three of the characteristics of deficits in social communication and social interaction, but only two out of four of the characteristics of restricted repetitive patterns of behavior, interest, and activities. So there are rules for being given the diagnosis that, yes, you must meet. But then the second issue comes in as to severity. So if, in fact, a person meets diagnostic criteria for a specific condition, say a reading disorder, okay, and yes, you meet the diagnostic criteria of difficulties with sight word decoding, reading fluency, and reading comprehension, we can give you the diagnosis, but then there's a question of severity. Some people can't read much at all. Some people just read a little more slowly, and some people really can do okay. It's just they need extra help with understanding or comprehending what they read. So there are two issues. One is, do you meet the criteria? The second is, what's the severity of the impairment?
Okay. That's very helpful, actually. That's very clarifying, I think. Dr. Nichols, we have really appreciated all of your, thoughts and insights on the DSM, and I'm just wondering if you'd like to share a little bit about your group, your clinical psychologists, and, you know, what you do and what your group can offer to this population.
Certainly.
Yeah, we'd love to hear that.
Okay, I'll keep it brief. We're located in Scottsdale, and we have a group of practitioners who we have five clinical psychologists and one speech-language pathologist. We see people across the age range, but many of our clients are individuals with developmental disorders, meaning that they have grown up with their conditions as opposed to having acquired them later in life. And we can provide a full range of diagnostic services, but also treatment groups, individual treatment, family therapy, speech-language therapy as well. So we have a website, www.thenicholsgroup.com. And
we'll have that link on our Facebook.
Yeah, we're going to post your contact information on our Facebook page, if that's okay.
Okay. For those people who have questions, we're always willing to take phone calls or meet with you for a brief period of time to see if we can help you or not. So people are welcome to give us a call.
Well, Dr. Chris Nichols, thank you so much for coming
on
Understanding Autism. It's been very enlightening. We'd love to have you on again. And, of course, everyone should check out the Nichols Group, but you'll have it on the Facebook.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely going to post the information. And Paul and I, and we just want to thank you so much again for taking the time to be with us and share this information.
Well, it's my pleasure. I think you provide a great service with your show, and I'm honored to have had the chance to participate.
Oh, thank you so much. And we'll be back in touch with you because we want to schedule you for another show. And I already have a few ideas in mind.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care now.
Thanks.
All right. You too. And, of course, that's Dr. Chris Nichols. The Nichols Group. Very, very interesting. DSM number 5, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. This could go on. I mean, we could have talked for hours and hours more. There's probably a lot to this. And, Paul, it sounds like you read some of this stuff.
I tried to do my research before the show.
That was very good.
He is.
But the thing we want to tell people, it doesn't sound like anyone should really be concerned, right?
It's worth being aware of what's going on.
Right,
but the goal is a good one.
Yes.
And hopefully if everything turns out the way it's supposed to, you'll end up with better treatment options.
I like that. And that's always a great goal for everyone. And you guys will be back tomorrow, 3 to 4. What's the topic?
Symptoms and diagnosis.
We're going to be sort of talking about the same topic, but from a different angle. Not so much about the manual, but just about the general process of diagnosis.
Oh, great idea. That's 3 to 4 tomorrow, Tuesday, 3 to 4, Understanding Autism. Guys, I will see you tomorrow. Have a great night, everyone. Oh, contact for you guys.
Yes. You can contact me at rdiarizona@yahoo.com.
Or post questions on our Facebook page at facebook.com/understandingautismradio.
And definitely check it because we're going to post some announcements and things on there this week.
Thank you. See you tomorrow.